All right, without further ado, it gives me great pleasure to introduce our speaker tonight, Mr. Bob H. Yeah.
Let me get situated here, guys. I brought my crutch here. Can you still see me?
Yeah.
Good.
We hear you.
I know I'm among friends, and that's the beauty of these rooms, is you're among friends. First of all, my name is Bob Heim. I was born 1941, March 24th, 1941. So next month I'll be 83 years old. I'm probably older than anybody in the room, and there's only one reason for that. Because I was born before you were. So, I'm not smarter, I'm not anything else. It's just, I've had a beautiful life. A lot of regrets, a lot of trials, a lot of tribulations. And I'll share some of those with you tonight. The first thing I want to make sure that everybody understands that I've been sober longer than Jim R. I am better looking than Jim R. And I'm fucking nicer than Jim R. So we'll get that out of the way right here at first. And if I piss you off, Jimmy, I already don't give a shit.
No cross-talking.
I'm not cross-talking. I'm talking straight. Okay. I had a normal childhood. Exactly. No, it couldn't, because it was. Oh, shut up, Richard. I had a normal childhood, okay? Because it was normal for me to have my my mother get drunk. It was normal for me to have her take me and my sister, put us in our pajamas, and she'd put us in the back of the car. And her and her friend would take off drinking someplace. And I remember being in the back of the car, standing up. There had no seatbelts in those days. There was no such thing as seatbelts. And the car would be going around in a circle because she'd lose control of the car. And I didn't come to, but I mean, we ended up in a ditch somewhere out in the middle of no place. The buses stop and pick us up and what have you. That was normal. That was a normal childhood. It was normal for me. My dad owned an operator at the bar up in King City, which is about 100 miles north of here. And he would close the bar up. He'd come home and my mother would be drunk. And they'd get in a fight. And my dad was a big man. Just as big as me, if not bigger. And I've seen him take his fist and hit her and knock her into the corner over there, she'd roll up like a ball. And she says, "Is that all you got, you son of a bitch?" And the fight was on. And I remember getting in between him and her and just saying, "You know, Dad, please don't hit her anymore. Please don't do this anymore." And like I say, my dad owned an operator bar. He was very respected around the town. And people loved him because he was a good man. He was a kind man. But she just had a way of getting under her skin, and he just couldn't take it, you know. And she just had a way of doing that. And so that was my life. I didn't like going to school. So what I'd do sometimes is in the morning, when Ma would come in to wake me up and go to school, she'd say, "Are you okay?" I said, "No, I don't feel good." "What's wrong?" I said, "I think I'm sick." So she'd take a give me a thermometer, and I'd take the thermometer, rub it on the sheets, get it up about 5,000 centigrade, you know. And of course, it would max out, and then she'd come in and see that I had a fever. So I got out of going to school. So what did I do? I just lay there, pull the covers over my head, and I just started fantasizing, and I'd go into another world. And basically, I just got out of, I really was not a real happy kid. But I didn't like the turmoil. I didn't like the arguments and the stuff that went on. So my refuge, in a lot of ways, was I'd go to work on ranches. There's a lot of ranches around there. So I'd go to work. The first one I went, I was about 13 or 14 years old. There was no work permits in those days. So we'd go to I'd go to work on a ranch up in out of King City there, and you'd live there. And on the weekends, we'd have Sundays off, and so a bunch of us kids would get together, we'd get a bunch of beer, and we'd go up into Arroyo Seco, which is one of the places, swimming hole up there. We'd all get drunk, and I remember the first time I got drunk was right there at the cemetery in King City. What a hell of a nice place to get drunk in a cemetery, we got this guy to get us some wine. And I remember drinking that wine. It was Tokay wine. It made me sicker than a damn dog, and I threw up all over the damn place. But the one thing I noticed that it did, it just made things just go away. It just made my troubles go away, and basically I felt good. Had a lot of fun. So after that, any time I could get drunk, I would, That worked. I worked on ranches here and there and what have you. I was a good hand. I remember there was a guy that lived across the street from us, and he had a little ranch, and he took me up there, and my dad didn't have time for me, so he just basically was kind of my surrogate father. And I've had a lot of surrogate fathers in my life, and I've run across some of the best men. Some good man that actually cared about me, because I didn't think anybody cared about me at all. I thought that I was less than, and I was always trying to impress everybody. I wanted to show you how wonderful I was, even if I had a low opinion of myself. I wanted to make sure that everybody thought I was good and thought I was worth living. And I remember it was the 9th of February, 1959. Me and another kid from school, I was 17 years old, and him and I got out and stuck our thumb out. These two black guys in a 53 Ford convertible picked us up. We were going up to Oakland, California to go in the Air Force. Now, I had a real problem with authority, and you'll notice that here when I read things to you here in a bit, because I got some archives here I brought with me. But so he picked us up, and they took us. We went to the St. Francis Hotel in Oakland, California, and they drove us right to the door of the hotel. We went in, and that night, him and I both went out and got drunk. The next day, they did your physical and do your tests and all that stuff. And then the next day, on the 11th of February, I was inducted into the U.S. Air Force, and we took off and flew to Midland, Texas, and then I landed in the Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas for my basic training. I had my 18th birthday in basic training in Lackland Air Force Base, and I was really a child, mentally a child, and basically wanting to, in those days, I was talking with Tommy here, and in those days something would come up and something about the country, and I would just almost cry when I looked at the flag, and I was very patriotic, and I thought that things were wonderful. I got in the Air Force, and it was right after Korea, but it was before Vietnam. So my period of time in there was a peacetime, And I got in there, and I figured, well, I'll do the best I can do. And then basic training, I graduated. My date of rank was 5 May of 1959, and they inform you at that time of what your FSN be, what your serial number is going to be, and basically what your vocation is going to be. And they told me very specifically, they said, well, you're going to be an apprentice cook. I said, what? I'm going to be what? You're going to be an apprentice cook. I said, I don't be no cook. No, I don't want to be no damn cook. So they informed me I was going to be a cook. And so that kind of disappointed me. So I remember I went from there, went home, and then they had a permanent change of station for me. I was supposed to go to, of all places, Las Vegas, Nevada, Nellis Air Force Base. So I showed up there, and they didn't need any cooks there. They had civilian cooks. They didn't need GI cooks. So I worked in the officers club for a little bit until they restationed me down to Cannon Air Force Base in Clovis, New Mexico. So I went down there in June of 59. And I got there, and they got an airman's club. In the airman's club, you go in the club. I don't care if you're 15 years old. If you're on the base, you can go in the Airman's Club and you can get all the drinks that you want. And okay, let's go do that. You know? So I did. And I figured, you know, like I said, I was very, very impressed with the service, and I wanted to do my job, and I wanted to be the best airman that I could possibly be. So working in the mess hall there, there was a mess sergeant, Sergeant Smith, and there was a young boy that was the same rank as I was, because I was an airman third. And this kid worked in the supply room. Well, I'm out there working my ass off, and this kid's doing nothing in there. And the kind of a funny thing, because he was making rank and I wasn't. Because for one reason, why, is he was kissing ass and I wasn't. I was working and he was kissing butt and making rank. And I didn't like that. It pissed me off, you know. So I started having a few drinks here and there and what have you, and the next thing I know, I'm in trouble, you know. And I'll read you a little something. This is part of the archives of, and I'm not proud of this, not at all, but it's just an example. You've already read it, Lynn. But and this is from an air policeman. His name is Airman Campos, Airman First Class. And he says that approximately 1915 hours, which is 7:15 in the evening, 2 March 1961, I, Airman First Class Campos, while on routine base patrol, received a call from CS, a charge of quarters, to go to Barracks 503, that's my barracks, room 43, and wake up Airman Basic Heim and tell him to report to work. Upon arrival at Airman Basic Heim's room, I found him half-dressed in his working uniform, sleeping on his bed. After trying to wake him up without any success, Airman Gatewood, friend of mine, and another airman finally got him up. Airman Basic Heim sat on his bed, mumbling. Airman Gatewood got a wet sponge, gave it to Mr. Heim, and told him to go over his face. When I saw Airman Heim, he was fully awake. I left for Mess Hall 1. Airman Heim appeared to be under the influence of alcohol. I notified Sergeant Herpesch, the NCO in charge, Mess Hall 1, that Airman Heim was under the influence of alcohol. I notified Sergeant Herpesch he had been woken up, said he'd been, and Herpeck said that he didn't want him there at the mess hall because he'd been drinking excessively a few hours prior and would not be able to do his job. And he was right, I wouldn't be able to do my job. So he says he called the mess sergeant, and the mess sergeant said he wanted me detained overnight. So that was one. That was the start. And after that, I just couldn't get along with anything or anybody. I'd get in an argument, I'd get in a fight with somebody. I had all kinds of personality clashes, and because I always thought that somebody was trying to belittle me in some way, shape, or form. So what was I going to do? I was going to fight. That's all there was to it, you know. And I could go on and on and on and on about different things here that happened, but it came to this. This is the 22nd of March. It culminated in this a letter. It says, subject, recommendation for elimination of Airman Heim under the provisions such and such. So I recommend that Mr. John R. Heim be discharged from the United States Air Force under the provisions of paragraph such an AFR 396 for unsuitability. Recommend Airman be furnished a general discharge. Okay, I had that coming. They sent me down to a psychiatric evaluation down in Roswell, New Mexico. I seen Lexi had a shirt on tonight, kind of reminded me of Roswell, New Mexico. So there was a psychiatrist down there by the name of Captain Rubin. Now, if any of you have been around here a little while, you might remember a book a few years back called Everything You Want to Know About Sex But Was Afraid to Ask. That was written by Dr. David R. Rubin. That's the same Captain Rubin. He seen me there. And basically, I had a negative attitude. I had a negative attitude. It says right here, I had a negative attitude towards authority. And I did. I had, if you said you were smarter than I was, you said that you were whatever, we had a problem. And I just didn't know how. It's not that I didn't respect anything. I just didn't know how to get along with anything. So alcohol gave me a way to be what I wanted to be. And after I got out of the Air Force, I left, I was discharged on the 5th of April, 1962, 2 weeks after I turned 21. I turned 21 in March of 62, and went back to King City, went back to working on ranches here and there. And then I started hauling grain for a guy, and he ended up being my father-in-law. I met his daughter on the 30th of June in 1962, fell madly in love, and then I went to work for him on the 4th of July in 1962, working cattle, farming, whatever. He had a sharecrop situation out of King City, up around, what if you know where Hunter Liggett is, or Holon. So he was, he had about a 7,000 acre ranch up there where he was leasing and what have you. And so I went to work for him, and he custom harvested too. We harvested grain and whatever. And I was a good cowboy. I cowboyed as a young man, and I just loved working on ranches. And it's funny because you know, here I had all this, these things of inferiority. And the fact of the matter, I really wasn't inferior. I was a very good hand. And I was very smart. And it just takes something to get that, to get it out of you, where you can just basically understand that you are not inferior. You are not less than, you know. But you have to understand that quit beating yourself up. And that's what I did when I drank, is I just went out and I made, there's an old saying, so let's go out and let's go get drunk and be somebody, you know. And you know, I can go back on the archives here and look at all this stuff here and all that, and it don't mean a damn thing. What it means to me is, okay, that's my past. That's what happened. That's what I did. How am I gonna change how am I going to change my life here to where I can not get along, but just be comfortable and feel worthy? And, you know, I found out that I am. I am worthy. But not until I came into these rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to work for Union Oil on the 18th of February, which is 55 years ago today, 18th of February, 1969. In Kalinga, California. I don't know if you know where Kalinga is. Yeah. Hanford. Oh my God. Hanford. Yeah. I'll sing the song for you. But I went to work there, and funny, because to go to work there, there was a guy that I had worked for on a ranch. I was foreman for him out of Paso Robles. His name was C.D. Hillman III. The third. They used to call him C.D. the Turd. And he was a trip. And he was really quite an old boy. He was about 20 years older than I was, really. He was born into a family. It was a rich family that had a lot of property. And he was a hard-working man himself, but he was a trip to work for. We had another guy work with me. His name was Jim Bell. And Jim was an old drunk that had been in jail many, many times. And him and I were good friends. he was quite a character, because I know one time he was out in, he was drinking out there in Paso Robles at one of the bars. And he told the bartender, he said, you know, exactly at 4 o'clock, he said, I'm going to run through that plate glass window there. What? Yeah, I'm gonna run through it. Sure shit, 4 o'clock, bang, he goes crash through this window, you know. He just crazier than a pet coon, you know. And I could relate with him. You know, him and I got along real good. And we had a thing with Cooch, because Cooch, C.D. Hillman III, we call him Cooch. And Cooch was, like I say, he was quite a character, and he had a way about him that was just, he just pissed you off. You know, he would piss you off, but he was kind in a lot of ways. And I was going to go to work for Union Oil Company in Kalinga. And he wrote me this letter. And this is to Union Oil. And I didn't find this out until many, many years later, after I left Union Oil. He says, "Dear Union Oil, in regards to Robert Heim, he was chosen to work on my ranch after extensive interview with 30-some people. He said, Bob is dependable." Excuse me, guys. If I have him. Hey, Jim.
There's water right there.
That's your father's water. Jim, never mind. Jim, I don't need your fucking help, Jim. He says, "I'm sorry, guys, don't pay no attention to me, I'm just an idiot." He said, "Bob is dependable and quite able to operate trucks and tractors during night and daytime." Yeah, they got lights. And it says, "Also has a fair knowledge of welding. He was also able to put out the most, and with proper motivation, he could become a foreman. Although at the time, he was too young to accept such responsibility and admitted it, which was the one reason he did not stay with me. Trained to your methods and procedure, I am sure that he would be very satisfactory on a permanent basis. This young man is clean in appearance and conducts himself well. And he demonstrated to me that he had courage, and yet he was not careless nor accident prone. As you already know, he is married and has 2 children, and he wants to better himself and his family. He is smart and only needs good opportunity to put it to good use. He is very healthy and is strong and is no way disabled. Learning your job and establishing himself eventually on a permanent basis will be his objective, and on that basis, I know he will be a good employee." Okay, well, that was a very nice letter that he wrote. So I go to work for Union Oil Company. But I was still an alcoholic, and I was still drunk, and I hadn't done anything to correct anything that I had did. And so Kalinga was a place you could drink and carry on and what have you, and I did. And then I went offshore in May of 1970, went to work on Platform A, then Platform B on the Santa Barbara Channel, and as a roustabout. And I worked there for a pretty good while. I was living in Ventura and driving back and forth to the Carpinteria Pier. So that's about a 25, 30 mile drive one way. And I worked like that for a good while until, and I was getting drunk occasionally every now and then. I'd call in sick and the company, you know, they'd slap my hand a little bit and what have you. And I decided, well, I'm going to straighten up here and I'm going to do things right. And I did. Straightened up pretty good. And then one day, and this was on the 5th of February, 1975, we had after work, we went into a safety meeting in Carpinteria. And after that safety meeting, well, the guy said, "Hey, let's go get a couple of beers." Okay, fine. So we all went to Tugboat Annie's, which is a little beer bar there in Carpinteria, and had a few beers. And then went next door to the Palms. It's one of the bars there in Carpinteria. And I had a couple of gin and tonics. And then I went out. I had an old little car that would kind of die all the time every time you mess with it a little bit. So I'm driving along, and the damn thing dies, and I start it back up. I get home, and I go to pull in my driveway, and I see the lights on behind me. It's cops. Oh, shit. So I stopped right there in my driveway. Cops say, "Well, Mr. Heim, how you doing?" I said, "Oh, okay, fine." He said, "Well, you been drinking?" I said, "No." You know, I didn't think I was drunk, you know. So he says, "Well, touch your nose, touch your toes, do all this stuff." And, well, I didn't do too good, I guess. And so he said, let's... And meanwhile, he called a backup, right? So there was a backup there, and a big old boy. And he said, "Well, let's go down to the station." I said, "Hey, I'm home. I'm right here at home. My wife and kids are looking out the window as I'm stopped right there where the cops got me stopped." I said, "Well, I'm home." And this cop What he did is, I didn't know, but he gets behind me. He takes my head and beats it down against the car. And bang, you know, and then he gets me out, puts cuffs on me, throws me in the back of the car. I couldn't believe it. I hadn't done a thing to him, you know. It just blew me away. I got back there thinking, I said, "You little son of a bitch. You know, you little son of a bitch." And the next thing I know, I come to in a cell in a straitjacket in Carpinteria. In a cell, right? Okay. I had totally lost it. I had lost all consciousness, all sanity whatsoever. And that had happened to me before, but not to that degree. You know? And you know, I don't know if you've ever been in a straitjacket. I know you have, Jim. Well, I'll tell you what, it's not a damn easy thing to get out of. So, and then I remember my wife come in there to get me out of jail. And, well, I'll tell you how mad she was. The hair was standing up on her back. So mad she was. And she comes in there, and I looked at her and I said, "Don't you say a damn word. Don't say nothing." So she was smart. She didn't. I went home. I was pissed. I was mad at that cop. I was going to kill that son of a bitch. I didn't give a damn. I was mad. And I worked with this old boy offshore, and he was quite a character, this buddy of mine. He was a bit older than I was, and he just had a lot of common sense. And he noticed something was wrong. He said, "What the hell was wrong with you?" I said, "I'm pissed." "What are you mad about?" So I told him. He said, "Well, what are you going to do about it?" I said, I'm going to kill that cop.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, I've killed a lot of deer. I'm born, raised, and killing deer, you know. I can handle it, you know, I know that. And I was mad. I was going to kill that son of a bitch. That's all there was to it. He said, "You know what, Bob? He said, you ought to kiss him." I said, "What?" He said, "You ought to kiss that son of a bitch." He said, "He did you a favor." He said, "You are a menace to society." And I was. And you know, I got to thinking about that, and I got to thinking, what the hell is wrong with me? And I remember driving back and forth to work sometimes. I would hear Santa Barbara, the AA in Santa Barbara, they would get over the radio and they would talk about, and they were talking something about blackouts and this and that. It never dawned on me what a blackout was. And I said, you know, I kind of correlate with that. So when I get out there, now, meanwhile, me and my buddy of mine, we're working on the rigs. And all we got to do is take readings every 2 hours, what have you. Go around, get the readings, make sure all the welds are producing, all that stuff. I can sit there and talk on the phone all night. I get my helper to go out and do stuff too, so I can sit there and talk on the phone. Well, I got to thinking about things, and I said, you know, I think I'm going to call AA. So I put a call into the central office. This young lady there, well, she's an older lady. Her name is Katie Doty. You remember Katie? Yeah. And she said, "Well, what's going on? Do you think maybe you have a drinking problem?" I said, "Well, I may have, you know." And she says, "Well, would you like to talk to someone?" So she has this guy call me, and this guy calls me, and he's got a Bostonian accent. Speaks very well, just like Tommy here. He speaks very well, and you can just tell the intelligence when you're talking to this man. And I had a mental picture of his Bostonian accent. I had a mental picture of what he looked like, you know. So I talked to him for about a week, on and off. He said, "Well, would you like to go to a meeting?" I said, "Well, yeah." So he said, "Well, come on in." So you meet there. I don't know if you're familiar with Santa Barbara, but there's Milpas Street, and then there's Salinas Street, and there's a little street called Indio Muerto, which means dead Indian. And he lived down there in an old converted lab bathroom, if you would put it that way. And I went down and I met him. And here's this little guy. You know, I had this image of what he looked like. And here is this little guy about this tall. He's got a goatee down to his belly button. He's got hair down the crack of his ass, and he's got a a pair of bib overalls on. He's got a patch on his crotch that says Magic Mountain. And I looked at him and I said, what? And he says, am I what you expected? I said, no, you're not what I expected. Not even close, you know. But you know, there's a little voice that talked to me and it said, you know what, Bob? You've been listening to him. He's made sense. Why not just maybe just listen a little bit longer until you find out what's really going on? And I did. And me and that old boy have become pretty good friends. And he was my sponsor for a good while and turned my whole life around. And so my first meeting was on Santa Barbara Street, and probably maybe a week after, maybe the 12th of February or something like that. Excuse me. No, I can't answer right now. I'm busy, my baby. So at any rate, where was I? Oh, yeah. Santa Barbara Street. And I remember going in there and sitting down, and there was a whole bunch of people, all women and guys and what have you. And everybody's happy and everybody's talking. And I just felt, hey, these people seem like they know each other a little bit, you know, and then it all went around. They all introduced themselves and alcoholics and what have you. And they come around to me and it says, I'm Bob and I'm not sure if I'm an alcoholic. They said, okay, fine. And I really wasn't sure. But then after being here for a while, it was common to me that I understood that, you know, I have a problem. And I was one of those, and it might be strange because you might think, well, you know, you don't have to drink every day. You don't have to stay stoned all the time. You just don't have to work that way. And, excuse me, somebody just keeps calling me. Oh, it's my answering machine now.
Shut up.
But you know, I didn't get drunk. I didn't stay drunk every day. I might go 2 or 3 months. I might go 6 months, never have a drink. But once I got started, I was on a runner drunk until I got done. Until I got done, you know. And all kinds of blackouts and all kind of crap. You know, I came to in some strange places. And to go back in the archives a little bit, I remember waking up in a field in Mule Shoe, Texas, snowing, middle of a field, naked. You know, in the snow. How in the shit did I get here? You know? And I could go back ad infinitum. How in the hell did I get here? What in the hell? And I'll tell you, I've said this before too, I woke up many times with my nose in somebody's friggin' armpit and afraid to open my eyes. And just hoping to hell that it's a woman. You know? Because I don't know why the hell it is, because whenever I got drunk and there was a gay around, that sumbitch would hit on me like you couldn't believe, you know? And I don't know why. Keith has a problem with midgets. And you know, I was sober about 3 years, and my wife and I were going to go through a divorce. And I was still working for Union Oil. And I was a foreman by that time. And they have to give you physicals every year. So they sent me down to Union Oil Center, which is on 6th and Bixtel down in L.A., right? They sent me down there for my annual physical. And the doctor asked me, is everything okay? So, well, you look okay, fine. And also I found out something else, too. They do this, not to get real personal, but they do this rectal exam. So they take the scope and they go in dark areas and they look at things. And the doctor asked, so he said, you don't drink, do you? No. I said, how do you know that? He said, but because, he said, you're pink, you're not red. I said, what? He said, well, your interns are, you're not agitated. You know, alcohol agitates your internals. I said, no shit, Doc. And you know, he said, yeah. He said, if you've been drinking, he said, I can tell just by this scope whether you drink a lot. You know, not if you were just a moderate drinker, no, but if you drank a lot, they could tell. I said, that's nice to know. So he said, well, is everything going okay? I said, well, no, I said, I'm having some trouble. I said, you know, at home, we're having trouble. He says, my wife and I said, we're going to probably go through a divorce and what have you. He says, so I'm sorry to hear that. I said, yeah. She's a good woman. I said, we just kind of grew apart, you know. He said, well, how would you like to find out something about yourself? I said, sure, now I'm 3 years sober. So this was probably February of 78. And he says, well, how would you like to go to the Meadows? I said, the Meadows, what's the Meadows? He says, that's a recovery situation in Wickenburg, Arizona for a month. And so I said, sure. So I went to the Meadows for a month. And that was probably one of the most beautiful times I ever spent in my life with the counselors there. And they knew that I was sober. And they knew that I had an AA program. And I was working things, working my life and what have you. And they, I've seen them bring in wet drunks right off the street. And these are not dumb people. They're not... They were actually very, very intelligent people. There was one guy in there was a brain surgeon, and he had a problem with alcohol, and he just couldn't get off alcohol. But he came there to the Meadows to help him straighten up, just like he would go to Betty Ford or whatever, you know. Well, it ended up, the wife and I still got a divorce, and that's a whole different story. And that was in 78. And then ended up going, well, I think it was in 81. I had been offered a job in Malaysia offshore for Esso or Exxon. And Union Oil countered offered with, because I was working for Union, and I'd been working for them for 13 years at that time. They had countered offered with a foreman job in offshore in the Gulf of Thailand. So I went to Thailand and I worked over there for about 5 years with the Union. Went to meetings in Bangkok, and then I would leave and go sometimes to meetings in Singapore and to Hong Kong and Jakarta. And then I ended up going to Korea for about a year. We built some rigs in Korea at Hyundai Heavy Industries. And all that time, I was sober, but I was working with a bunch of guys that weren't sober. And I was working with a bunch of guys that loved to drink. And sometimes I would accompany them and not drink because they needed a little help sometimes. And these guys, I remember one time in Singapore, went down there, was a guy, his name was Freddie. Freddie was one of the foremen. And they would get there and they would get drinking and what have you. And in Singapore, in Bangkok, well, in Bangkok and Thailand, they've got what they call a lady boy. And it's actually a transvestite, right? Oh, you know. Yeah. And this buddy of mine, he was a foreman, his name was Fred Sander. We go to Singapore, and Freddie's out of his mind, and he's sitting there with this Billy boy, it's a lady boy. And this guy, he's over there sucking on this guy and kissing him on the ear and what have you. And he doesn't have a clue, and I'm taking pictures of it all the time. So I'm a rotten bastard, I'm sorry. But you know, it was just an education. Now, I was thinking here about one of the times I spent over in Thailand. I had a car over there, and I had a driver, and that somebody's got me in three wrecks, so I said, I can drive just as good as he can. So, but the thing of it is, you're driving on the wrong side of the car. You're driving on the wrong side of the road, because their cars are built different. You know, you're driving like you would in England. And I took a trip one time from Bangkok up to Chiang Mai. It's about 700, about 400 miles, 700 kilometers, something like that, 400 miles. So I go up there and I'm just kicking around there. I was staying in a place in Chiang Mai. And then I figured, well, this one day I'm going to go take a little drive and just go out in the country, just kind of explore a little bit, just myself, you know. So I went from Chiang Mai to towards Chiang Rai, and I noticed this sign, big sign up on the other said Elephant Corral. And so I turned in, and I remember going in there, just a road, and the road with the weeds were about as high as this building. You're going right down over here, just a lane going through there. And then I got out and opened up in this one spot, and here was this just big open area there, then there was like a barn. And there was a sign there that said Elephant Corral. And I drive up there, and these little kids about this tall, they come out there, and they've got this, it's a menu, right? Because they can't speak any English, but so they have this menu, and they say, hand me the menu. And it says, no, can't speak English, but would you like to ride elephant? Would you like to do this? So I said, sure. So I give them 10 baht or whatever, you know. And here this little kid, about as big as that little dog there, this little kid, he comes over and he gets this friggin' elephant. This elephant is giant. He takes him over, they go in the river down there. The elephant lays down in the river, he gets a bucket, and he's washing this elephant off, you know. This little bitty kid. I'm thinking, my God, and these kids were so happy. It just seemed like they just enjoyed their life, you know. They weren't rich by any means, but they had a beautiful life, you know. And I was so impressed by that. It's just, you know, you don't really have to be rich to enjoy your life. You know, you don't have to. And that's something that I always thought. I had to have a big house. I had to have a big car. I had to have this. I had to have that. Or I'm not successful. Bullshit. You know? I am very successful today because I am happy today. I don't see a, except for Jim. That sumbitch hates me. He hates me. I know he does. Because he tells me so all the time. But you know, we've got kind of a camaraderie going on because I know damn well that I can count on Jimmy.
Yeah.
And I know damn well I can count on Tommy. And I know I can count on Lynn. And I can count on Billy. And I can count a lot. There's a lot of things today. I love people today. I do love people today. Except for that little Mexican over there. And I don't know if you noticed or not. If you didn't notice, he just gave me the finger. That's why I call him a little Mexican. You know. Yeah, it's 8 o'clock, guys. Thanks for helping me.
Good job, Bob.
Oh, yeah.